With only 1 week to go until Election Day, John Kerry is bringing out the big guys. Today, fresh from major heart surgery, former President Bill Clinton hits the campaign trail with Kerry, speaking to 1,000 African-American preachers in a conference call today. Yesterday, former Vice President Al Gore was in Florida visiting black churches in what the New York Times describes as a pulpit parade. Why all the focus on black voters? Well, a recent survey from the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies, an organization that focuses on issues important to black Americans, found that the Democrats are losing some support among black voters. In 2000, Al Gore got 90% of the vote. David Bosaitis, senior research associate at the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies, has one explanation.
During the second Clinton term, African Americans made huge income gains, record low unemployment, home ownership, college attendance, about all the social and economic indicators that you could mention improved substantially in that second Clinton term. And when Al Gore ran, he was rewarded for that second Clinton term.
Well, John Harwood is national political editor for The Wall Street Journal. He joins us now. And John, that's one reason. But what are some other thoughts about the apparent slippage of African-American votes in 2004?
I think, Robin, some of this is illusory. In fact, a lot of times you see in polling near an election, Democrats underperforming among black voters, and you get to Election Day and they end up doing a lot better. In our Wall Street Journal NBC poll, we showed John Kerry getting 83% of the African-American vote and very high interest among black voters. So I think certainly efforts like Bill Clinton and Al Gore have been engaging in over the last few days will help fire up that vote. But I think it is likely to be a very strong vote for John Kerry and a vote in substantial numbers.
Well, don't Republicans also feel that this time around they have an opening on an issue with African Americans, and they've been working very hard in the churches on the issue of gay marriage?
They do. A lot of African-American voters are socially conservative, and so this is one way that President Bush can try to speak the language of black voters who he's had difficulty relating to on other issues. The question is whether that issue can overshadow the polarization that has otherwise driven African-Americans away from him on the economy and issues like the war in Iraq, which African-American voters are not very pleased with.
Is there another issue here, John? There's been some criticism that John Kerry, a reserved New Englander, is no Bill Clinton.
Well, that's true, and George W. Bush is a more talented and sort of naturally connecting campaigner than John Kerry. There's no doubt about that. And this is one of George Bush isn't Bill Clinton either, but he's better than John Kerry on that score. So John Kerry is certainly looking for all the help he can get, while also devoting a lot of energy and message attention to courting swing voters.
Well, John Harwood, while we have you, as you know, there's some late breaking news that Chief Justice William Rehnquist of the Supreme Court has been hospitalized. He's suffering from thyroid cancer. Of course, there are concerns about his health. But while we're discussing politics, the makeup of the Supreme Court has always been a critical campaign issue. Your thoughts on this news today?
Well, I think this may elevate the attention to the makeup of the court as a campaign issue. It's been it's always one of those things that activists close to politics or people who follow it closely, like you and I do, discuss a lot, but the average voter doesn't focus on very often. This is something that's going to raise that to the forefront, and it's not clear which side will benefit. Of course, social conservatives are very, very concerned with the makeup of the court. That's one of George Bush's legacies to the right so far after 4 years as president. So it is not clear that it'll help one side or the other, but it's going to push that issue front and center.
Well, and Chief Justice William Rehnquist is one of the more conservative judges. So if, in fact, his health forces him to retire and President Bush is still in office, it would be a conservative for a conservative.
Oh, yes, exactly. There's no question that if President Bush is reelected and has a chance to replace William Rehnquist, he's going to appoint a conservative to the court. And by the same token, that is not what John Kerry's going to do. And voters are certainly going to appreciate that distinction. There's been a lot of interest in, given the ages of so many of the justices, that there's been some surprise that he hasn't had the opportunity to appoint somebody already.
And he is 79, Chief Justice Rehnquist. John Harwood, thank you.
My pleasure.
John is national political editor for The Wall Street Journal. It's an old argument. Does genetics or environment have a greater impact on whether a woman will develop breast cancer? Well, a new national study hopes to get to the bottom of that question by following the lives of 50,000 women whose sisters have breast cancers. Researchers hope the 10-year study would provide them with clues to the genetic and environmental causes of the disease. Well, the role of genes in breast cancer is also the focus of a new Discovery Health Channel documentary, Breast Cancer Legacy. Here's a portion.
Since my mother's died, I feel like I'm going to die of cancer.
It's in my blood. It's in my genetic makeup. I have a mutation, and this is why I got cancer.
I think the great hope for genetic research is prevention.
The science is moving so fast that, you know, our laws, our policies never anticipated the complexity of what is before us now.
It empowered me. See, I know what I'm fighting.
Well, in a moment, we're going to hear from a couple of women who've made decisions about genetic testing. But first, we'll talk about genetic testing and breast cancer with that film's director, Beth Murphy. Hi, Beth.
Hi, Robin.
Here in the studio with me. And with Dr. Funmi Olapade, the director of the Center for Clinical Cancer Genetics at the University of Chicago Medical Center. Welcome, doctor.
Thanks.
And doctor, I'd like to start with you. Let's just, because I know a lot of people now are saying, what, if they haven't heard about this before? Genetic testing, how do you get that test?
It's a simple blood test, but we recommend that you get it only after you've had a thorough discussion with a genetic counselor.
And we just want to be clear, if you have this genetic marker, it doesn't mean you will get cancer. And if you don't have the genetic marker, it doesn't mean you won't get cancer.
It's all about probability. And really, what we're trying to do with genetics is to help us do a better job of risk assessment. Everyone is at risk of getting cancer. Some people have a much higher risk. And this genetic test for breast cancer indicates that you have a higher probability of getting breast and or ovarian cancer, so that you can do something to lower your risk.
Right. So it's all about, as you said, probability.
It's all about probability.
Well, Beth Murphy, as you made your film, what did you find? Are more women taking this option of getting the test?
Well, they are. And really what it comes back to also is the demand for genetic counseling, which is really where it all begins, to really, you know, be put yourself in a position of power, a position of knowledge, so that even if you decide not to have the test for genetic mutation, you make that decision. That can be an informed decision. And, you know, for me, I have a family history of breast cancer. And, you know, 3 years ago, I produced another program specifically focused on young women and breast cancer. And what I learned in doing that program is that young women are more likely to be genetic mutation carriers. And I wanted to know why. And
what,
that was really...
Why is that?
Well, there's something called anticipation in genetics. And what it means is that if there is a mutation that's running down through the generations, that it would present itself earlier and earlier with each generation. Mm-hmm. And so when we see that, you know, women are really demanding genetic counseling more and more, what we've seen is that since the BRCA1 and 2 genetic mutations were identified in the mid-1990s, and those are the two genes that are linked to breast and ovarian cancer. At that time, when they were identified, there were about 600 genetic counselors in America. And today, that number's up about 300%. There are almost 2,000.
Beth, it sounds as if the first decision is whether or not to test. Once you do, what are some of the options after, you know, you've obviously had counseling?
Well, if a woman tests positive for a genetic mutation, there are a number of options. Some of them are more invasive than others. She can have increased surveillance to catch cancer earlier. That means mammograms, typically starting at a younger age, but also maybe adding MRIs to that as well, especially in younger women who have denser breasts and mammograms aren't always as effective. There's also preventive drug therapies like tamoxifen, which is a chemo prevention that women can decide to take, and that helps to block estrogen in the body. And then women can also decide on prophylactic surgery, removing the breasts and removing the ovaries, which have been shown to have a pretty dramatic reduction in breast and ovarian cancer risk.
Well, Beth, as you know, that last consideration is a controversial one. And I want to turn back to Dr. Olapade. Doctor, we want to make clear women should consult their own doctors on these issues. But I want to ask you one question. If a woman does decide to take a prophylactic step to have either breasts or ovaries removed, Does that remove all risk of getting cancer?
We do know that when you remove the breast, that you reduce the risk more than 95%. But, you know, there are no guarantees in life. We also know that when you remove the ovaries, it reduces the risk of ovarian cancer and then further reduces the risk for breast cancer.
Because it lowers the estrogen that might feed the cancer in the breast.
Absolutely. In fact, before we ever had chemotherapy, before we ever had hormonal therapy, doctors used to treat breast cancer by removing the ovaries.
Well, the film also brings up the fact that researchers are learning from identical twins. Beth, you followed two women, identical twins. One finds out she has cancer. The other one finds out she doesn't.
I actually showed them the x-rays, the mammogram film. And Jackie was mad. Her reaction was just like, oh, gosh, no, Janine, you can't have breast cancer. I can't believe you're even, you know, you're even telling me this. There's no way. She was actually mad. And I was like, well, Jack, it could be. I mean, this doesn't look good so far.
Well, Beth Murphy, who made that film, that's obviously a very powerful moment between twin sisters. But beyond their personal story, what are researchers learning from twins?
Well, because identical twins share their genetic makeup 100% as opposed to brothers and sisters who share 50% of their genetic material, researchers are really able to see the complexities of how the DNA is working in these women. So, for example, the women that we just heard talking, one of the women was diagnosed at the age of 29 with breast cancer. Her identical twin, it's now 5 years later, still does not have breast cancer. Well, why not? They were raised in the same home. They had the same environment. And the key really here is that just because they do have the same DNA doesn't mean that their cells are going to act exactly the same way. And although that does sort of confuse the issue and complicate it, researchers can learn a great deal from that.
Well, it's confusing, it's complicated, and as you all know, it's somewhat controversial. And Dr. Olapade, I know you have to go while we continue our discussion, but before you do, I just want to ask, couldn't this be disastrous for some women on an emotional level? How much is that taken into consideration?
Oh, actually, what we have found is that many of them come to me certain that they're going to get breast cancer. And when we go through counseling and we give them support, they all of a sudden realize that there's nature and there's nurture, that it's in fact not 100% that they're going to get cancer. And that's really empowering for them because it then allows them to put things in perspective.
Well, Dr. Olapade, in fact, we're going to speak to two women in a moment. One agrees with you and one might not. We thank you so much for your expertise.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And today we're talking about the issue of genetic testing and breast cancer. It's a powerful tool that can tell women if they're more at risk for developing breast cancer during their lifetimes. But it can also lead to some controversial choices. Some women decide to have their healthy breasts and ovaries removed in an attempt to prevent the possibility of cancer. Well, joining us again in the studio, Beth Murphy. She made the film Breast Cancer Legacy, which is airing on Discovery Health Channel this Thursday night. Hi again, Beth.
Hi, Robin.
And we're also joined now on the line by Karen Hall and Randy Rosenberg. They are two of the women featured in the film. They join us on the line. I want to welcome you both.
Good to be here.
And Randy, let's start with you. You're head of the group, a Young Survival Coalition. You found out at a very early age that you had breast cancer. And yet, how do you feel about the testing?
When I was diagnosed at 32 years old, it was a complete shock. There was no history of breast cancer or ovarian cancer in my family. And, you know, I was fortunate here in New York City to have a very savvy oncologist who put two and two together. She said, Randy, you are being diagnosed at a very young age. That's one red flag. Secondly, you are of Ashkenazi Jewish descent. That's a second red flag. What that says to me is that there may be some genetics at play. And she recommended genetic counseling almost from the very first consultation. And I said, you know what? This is a bit much for me to handle. I've just been told I have breast cancer at a very young age. In the end, I decided that that was not a path that I wanted to travel down.
Even though you've had a daughter.
Yes.
By the way, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
There's a 50-50 chance that if you have a mutation, you could pass it to your daughter.
Right.
So wouldn't you want her to know? Tell me your thinking there.
Well, you know, as far as my young baby is concerned, I think that there's still a lot that we don't know about the causation of breast cancer. And even if there is a mutation present, that is not necessarily, you know, indicative of the fact that you are definitely going to get breast cancer. So that's one point. The second point is I don't think at this stage, and I may think otherwise as she grows, that she needs to live her young life thinking about and being preoccupied with breast cancer.
We have Karen Hall on the line as well. Karen, you and three of your sisters were featured in the film. Your mom died of ovarian cancer. You found out that your family had a long history of ovarian and breast cancer. And by the way, how'd you find that out?
A fascinating story. My mother was an only child, but her cousin had already had ovarian cancer at an early age, along with her three sisters. And so it was my cousin who did all of this research and found these generations of women that had either had or died from either breast or ovarian cancer.
Right. Now, Karen, you were the first of your sisters to decide to get the genetic test. Your youngest sister, Becky, decided she didn't want to go through with it. Here's a portion of the film.
I feel like if I were to go through that and come back with a positive result, that I would be more paranoid, think about it more than I do now, which is, you know, I think about it a lot.
Well, Karen, you did have the test. You found out that you do carry a gene that makes you more susceptible to breast cancer, and you had your ovaries removed, as we learned, that removes some of the estrogen that might promote cancer. Well, how do you feel about taking that step, which a lot of people would say is a drastic one?
I had no problem whatsoever. I had just watched my mother die a long, painful death at a too early of an age, and I had this medical history chart in front of me with more women that I could believe that had, you know, also gone through the same experience. I considered myself lucky to know. I was the first woman in that family that had a chance to do something about it.
Yeah.
Found it empowering.
Right. And as we know, it reduces the risk of breast cancer, ovarian cancer, but it doesn't remove the risk completely. Do you think about it as your sister says she does?
No, I don't. I don't spend a lot of time thinking about it. I was grateful to know so I could do lots of things my mother never had a chance to do.
Beth Murphy, as you met these women who were making these decisions, how did most of them feel after the decisions were made?
I think Karen really, really nailed it with her response, which is they felt empowered. And I did find that most of the people who wanted to talk about this issue were women who had gone through the counseling, had made decisions as a result of it. And what was interesting to me is that, you know, most of the decisions sound like they're very medical in nature, to have surgery or not to have surgery, how many times a year to have a mammogram or an MRI. And while there are huge medical decisions to be made, as Randy said, this is such an intense personal issue, and there are tremendous psychosocial issues that go along with it for individuals as well as families, because when one family member decides to get tested, that has enormous implications mm-hmm. for the rest of the family. Mm-hmm. And there are feelings of profound guilt, survivor guilt.
Well, Karen, you initially had your ovaries removed, as we said, to help prevent breast cancer. And now you've decided to have a mastectomy to remove both of your breasts. What led you to make that decision now?
I spent, you know, several months researching the whole issue, talking to doctors, talking to women that had done this, looking at all my options, and now I feel very good about moving forward with this second surgery.
Because?
I am in a smaller area where cancer care is not as strong, and I want to lower my risk down to below the normal population.
And it sounds, Randy, that you're just as comfortable with your decision not to test, but you'd be comfortable changing your mind, too.
Well, I think, you know, again, it's very, very intensely personal, and people's lives change, people's circumstances change as they go about the course of their life. And at the time when I made my decision, and quite honestly, my oncologist still asks me that question. Mm-hmm. It's almost 6.5 years since my diagnosis, and she keeps asking, when are you going to have genetic counseling?
And let me ask you about that, Randy. Do you think that the profession is pushing this on women?
Oh, on the contrary. Most young women who should be referred for genetic counseling are actually being under-referred. Mm. So what's really necessary here is some physician education.
Well, I want to thank you all for joining us and telling us about your decisions when it comes to genetic testing. Karen Hall and Randy Rosenberg, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
And Beth Murphy, director of the film Breast Cancer Legacy. It airs on the Discovery Health Channel October 28th at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. For more information on the film and on the topic, I'm sure people have a lot of questions. Go to our website, here-now.org. Beth Murphy, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
tomorrow on Here and Now. We'll get back on the campaign trail with gasoline tipping $2 a gallon. We're going to look at the energy policies of both the Bush and Kerry campaigns. And we'll speak to the Green Party's candidate for president. Stay with us. More ahead Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. There's been a lot of news out of Iraq. This weekend saw the massacre of about 50 Iraqi army soldiers trained by the U.S. Iraqi officials say they may have been betrayed by infiltrators who trained alongside them. Meanwhile, the New York Times and CBS's 60 Minutes are reporting that an enormous quantity of high-density explosives, about 380 tons, are missing from an Iraqi military storage facility. Joining us first from Baghdad is Kimberly Dozier. She's correspondent for CBS Radio News. And Kimberly, the missing explosives first. You interviewed the Iraqi Minister of Science for 60 Minutes. What, in summary, is he saying?
Well, he's saying that as they took over sovereignty and started looking through their records of what should be in the various old weapons stockpiles across the country, they found something very serious was missing, about 380 tons of RDX and HDX. Now, this is a high-density type explosive in the Semtex family, about enough to fit in the palm of your hand, can blow up a plane. It is also the type of explosive that has been used in several Al-Qaeda attacks in, for instance, Bali, Saudi Arabia, and several of the bombing attacks in Pakistan. Basically, the Iraqi authorities went to the International Atomic Energy Agency and also to Bremer's old administration to say, where's this stuff gone? We've got to track it down.
Now, we understand that before the war, the sites were guarded, that UN inspectors at one time were guarding them as well. What happened? How could they be left unguarded?
Well, U.S. commanders we've spoken to about various types of weapons that have gone astray from these sites say they are enormous. It took tens of thousands of Iraqi soldiers in Saddam's time to secure them. And after the war, when U.S. troops were pouring in here and trying to establish control, they simply didn't have enough troops to fight an insurgency, stop the looting on the streets, and protect hundreds, if not thousands, of acres of these vast weapons facilities. So essentially, if someone knew where something important was, they could help themselves to it. That is what Iraqi officials are afraid has happened with this stuff.
Right. Kimberly, this weekend we also saw the massacre of 50 of the U.S.-trained army, Iraqi army trainees. They were in vans. They were forced out of the vans, most of them shot in the back of the head. Who's claimed responsibility, and how are the Iraqis reacting?
Well, Zarqawi's al-Qaeda-linked group has already claimed responsibility for the attack. Iraqis have been quite shocked by it because it indicated a level of knowledge that has made many Iraqi officials say this had to be an inside job. Somebody knew these men were leaving the base unarmed, headed for home leave, and that they could be found at a certain time on a deserted stretch of road. Now, one of the eyewitnesses says that an RPG was fired first at one of the vehicles, and then militants marched the rest of the men down out into the sand and lined them up in rows of 12 face down and shot them in the back of the head. Some people here have said it reminds them of the bad old days of Saddam Hussein's regime, that that's the kind of thing he used to do, and it's made a lot of people even more fearful than they already are for their safety and security.
And finally, before we let you go, Margaret Hassan, the British Iraqi woman who headed up CARE in Baghdad, who's been held hostage for several days now, has anyone claimed responsibility for her kidnapping?
At this point, all we know is that several people are lining up to say they are not responsible. A Sunni clerics association out of Fallujah has disavowed any association with it. One clerics group that has negotiated on behalf of other hostages says that it may step in and help free her. Also, a lot of Iraqi citizens have taken to the streets calling for her release, people who were directly affected by her aid and care over the years. And what her husband and her organization are hoping is that this groundswell of support will convince whoever's holding her that they've got the wrong woman.
Kimberly Dozier, correspondent for CBS Radio News. Kimberly, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, we just want to take a couple of minutes now to check in with Christopher Dickey, Middle East Regional Editor for Newsweek magazine. Christopher, we were just mentioning Zarqawi, who claims responsibility for the killing of the trainees in Iraq. any sense of what his position is now? And you begin an article on him in Newsweek by calling him a loser. He's not a loser anymore.
Well, he's not a loser in the sense that he used to be. He was kind of a wastrel as a young man, a drinker. He was in and out of jail, in and out of trouble. Now he's probably the most well-known jihadist in Iraq, even though he's not an Iraqi, he's a Jordanian.
I have your article here. You begin the article by saying, what a loser. Go on to say that Zarqawi's first terrorist operation in 93 was an utter failure. He was even apparently rejected by Al-Qaeda before setting up shop where he is now. Any sense of how he might be impacting the reconstruction, and any sense of why this attack on the U.S. trainees happened now? Is it because of the U.S. election?
I don't think it's just because of the U.S. election. It's part of an ongoing campaign that could be Zarqawi, could be the regular insurgency, that basically says, if you work with the Americans, you are not going to be safe. We will get you. And that's an important message for an insurgency to send. The message is, you know, your sponsors, the Americans, cannot protect you from us. That's a little bit different than the other things that Zarqawi has been doing, where he's been beheading Americans and Britons and other people on video. That's about building his international image. And at the bottom line for him is that Iraq is a stage, it's not a cause. And he represents actually a very small minority of the insurgency.
Yeah, but with a powerful impact. We've spoken before about the U.S. plan to, it's Iraqization. What are the impediments to setting up an army outside of a Zarqawi? What are the other impediments?
Well, the first and biggest impediment is the question of, if you will, Iraqi patriotism. The United States keeps trying to sell Iraqis on the idea that it is there only to liberate them and that it will leave at some time in the distant future when there is a democracy and a stable government. Most Iraqis just don't believe that. They believe that the United States is there to pursue its own interests, and the people who are joining the army being put together by the United States are people who are basically mercenaries. And that's unfair to a lot of fine people who have joined those forces, but that is a widespread perception. And a lot of these soldiers and policemen go home to be called traitors in their own neighborhoods.
Hmm. And as you point out, there's a long tradition of the U.S. trying to set up an apolitical police force in other countries, and it has not worked.
No, we have a terrible history of doing this. Since the 20s in Nicaragua, we have been going in, occupying countries, creating what we call apolitical constabularies or national guards. And when we leave an SOB that we like in charge, and he turns all that into an apparatus that sustains his personal power. It's a very long and almost too predictable history.
Hmm. And we just have a few seconds left. We just want to ask how you feel the hunt for Zarqawi is going. It's felt that he's held up in Fallujah.
I think there may be some interesting developments in that, because I think the mainstream insurgency, if you will, 90% of the insurgents are alienated by a lot of what Zarqawi is doing. He's becoming a political liability to them, even though he has a certain kind of bravura performance every so often that attracts a lot of attention on satellite television. So you may see a situation where some of the insurgents will turn against him, and that will make it much harder for him to hang out and hold out and hide out in a place like Fallujah.
Christopher Dickey, Middle East Regional Editor for Newsweek. Christopher, thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Here and Now. The construction of a new mosque in the Roxbury neighborhood of Boston has fueled a rift among the city's Muslim, Jewish, and civic leaders. The one-time spokesperson of the Islamic Society of Boston, or ISB, is being accused of making anti-Semitic remarks. Here and Now's Martha Biebinger has more on the story.
The latest charges stem from two articles written by Waleed Fatehi. He's currently listed as treasurer of the board at the Islamic Society of Boston, but the society says Fatehi now lives in Saudi Arabia and is no longer a director. 4 years ago, Fatehi, writing about violence at Jerusalem's Al-Aqsa Mosque, referred to Jews as, quote, the murderers of prophets, and said they, quote, have perpetrated the worst of evils and brought the worst corruption to the earth. Shortly after his articles were published in a London-based Arabic daily, Fatehi became a spokesman for the Islamic Society of Boston, or ISB, in response to September 11th.
Waleed Fatehi was the first face that we had contact with, and he was really representing ISB, especially in the immediate aftermath of 9/11.
Rabbi Ron Friedman with Boston's largest synagogue, Temple Israel, initially embraced Fatehi literally and figuratively as the two men organized interfaith services.
So to then read this person who was not a stranger in that sense, but someone who had been promoted as their spokesperson, it was with great, great concern.
After the articles came to Friedman's attention last winter, Temple Israel and the Anti-Defamation League repeatedly called on the ISB to denounce Fatehi. The ISB offered a variety of responses. The latest is that it does not condone Fatehi's statements. But chairman of the Society's board of directors, Yusuf Abulaban, argues that they have been taken out of context. Fatehi, according to Abulaban, was referring to Israelis involved in violence at one of Islam's holiest sites, not Jews in general. Abulaban argues that Fatehi has written hundreds of other columns advocating tolerance.
We do not have this attitude as Muslim to disregard someone who has done tremendous good throughout his life. If we disagree with him on one point, no, we do not throw him away.
Other Jewish and Christian leaders have not weighed in on the allegations of hate speech. The Massachusetts Council of Churches says it is reviewing the issues with an interfaith committee. The council's Islamic liaison says concerns about Fatehi's writings have been blown out of proportion. The ISB has appointed a new board of directors who for the first time live in the Boston area. The board says Fatehi's name will be removed once incorporation papers are revised. The board of trustees, most of whom live outside the country, will remain. But Abulaban says the trustees have transferred governing power to the directors, although the trustees will continue to hold title to the society's property. Traffic on Malcolm X Boulevard in Roxbury slows occasionally as drivers peer curiously at construction of the cultural center with a dome at one end and minaret in the middle. It's to be the largest Islamic center in New England. The mosque and part of the center is expected to open in the spring. Work is going ahead while the mayor's office and a Boston City Council committee review a reduced-rate land deal the society negotiated with the Boston Redevelopment Authority and Roxbury Community College. The Society has raised almost 10 of the $14 million needed to complete Phase 1. Leaders say they are soliciting donations in the U.S. and internationally, but say they accept no money with strings attached. Meanwhile, others are raising questions about the project and the Islamic Society's leadership. Assistant Professor of Political Science at Boston College, Dennis Hale, helped establish Citizens for Peace and Tolerance, which includes Jews, Christians, and Muslims. Hale says the Society's comments about Fatehi have tarnished public perceptions of the mosque.
When we see the anti-Semitic writings, the denial of the anti-Semitic writings, the obfuscation about his connection, there's just a number of things that all move in the same direction, which is that this will not be a center for moderate Islam. This will be a center for the same bad old radical Islam that everybody is trying to overcome.
The ISB plans to create an outreach office to improve relations outside the Muslim community. Chairman Abulaban says repairing connections with Jewish leaders is a priority.
We have a lot of common things. I do not claim that every Muslim community member have the same understanding. But are we forcing the issue? Yes. Are we trying to avoid any divisive issue and any issue which would bring anger or bring hateful? Absolutely. We do not consider it actually part of our teaching.
Leaders of the ADL and Temple Israel say they expect to meet with the ISB soon and will insist on getting assurances about respect and security. Representatives have been putting out feelers to decide how to proceed.
That report by Martha Biebinger. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. When I recently sat down with stage legend Elaine Stritch, it wasn't the first time. Years ago, we'd gathered Elaine and the rest of the over 50 female cast of the movie Cocoon: The Return for a quiet ladies who lunch tea party. I reminded her on this visit, it was anything but.
Those women that I was with are certainly not quiet broads at all. I mean, Maureen Stapleton, give me a break. And Gwen Verdon is a hellraiser. And so is Jessica Tandy. Oh, no, they're all too good to be quiet. Thank you for reminding me of that. That's terrific.
At 79, Elaine Stritch has a lifetime of movie and theater memories and an opinion about all of them, as the world found out when she won an Emmy Award this year for the HBO broadcast of Elaine Stritch at Liberty, her one-woman staged tell-all, which also won the Tony in 2002. Stritch stole that Emmy show, as she's burgled so many others in a career that includes roles in Pal Joey, Bus Stop, and Stephen Sondheim's Company. Elaine Stritch at Liberty is now out on DVD and CD and on tour here in Boston, where we talked with a woman who seems to have performing in her blood.
Well, I don't know about it being in my blood. I work agrees with me. It makes me, I'm not going to say happy, but it makes me satisfied, and it makes me okay with myself. I don't like the reputation that I seem to have acquired about being, I think I'm bossy. I'll admit to that. I think part of the reason is that I'm very sharp, I'm very alert, and I'm scared. I have a great deal of fear-based problems. And if I'm afraid, then I will come on strong. If I'm relaxed and I'm okay with me and I'm not scared of the person, then I'll be just exactly who I am, which is just adorable.
What is happening when you're doing your one-woman show? Which feeling is there?
Oh, that has nothing to do with what I'm talking about. Then I'm performing, and I'm telling my story. And then, you know, I certainly don't frighten the audience.
Some people would ask, if this is your story, and you're telling it, and it's your experiences, it's your friends, it's your life, where does the performance part come in? How would you rehearse it?
It's a play. John Lahr and I wrote a play about Elaine. It's very strange because, you know, art imitating life. This is life imitating life. I get to the theater and I start telling the story of my life and what I've been through, the good times and the bump times. I got a chance to audition for the standby to Ethel Merman in Call Me Madam, playing Pearl Mester, the American ambassador to Lichtenberg. I was 20 years old. I looked 40. I got the job. It is an escape because I become my own storyteller, my own writer, my own. I am playing myself. This is hard to explain. You've asked me a hard question, and I'm glad you did. But even playing myself, it's a relief.
And what did you find, and what did you want to tell?
Well, I found plenty. There was no difficulty in finding. Every time I go out, it seems to me, things happen to me. And I invite things to happen to me. I pick up lovely material that way. But not to perform. I just pick it up for my own good. I'm interested in people.
I just wanted to take a detour there, because when you say that things happen to you and you invite things to happen, I thought immediately of the Emmy Award presentation.
Yeah.
When you went out and you just stole the show. I mean, talk about a scene stopper. Did you know before you went up to accept that award, did you know what you were going to say? Did you know how much energy you were going to bring?
I had no idea. And when you get hit like that, you don't know what the hell you're talking about. You just go up and say whatever's on your mind.
I try not to drink, but I... the company I'm in. Just look at it. I mean, and I'm so glad none of them won. I'm so glad none of them won.
Back to what I was asking you before. It was for this, you won for the performance that we're talking about. And I guess, why did you decide to do it? I mean, had you always wanted to tell your story?
A lot of people had kept saying it to me all the time I was growing up in the theater. You ought to do, because I'm a good storyteller, and I'm fun and games at parties, and, you know, I'm a heel kicker-upper.
Did you ever think twice about including the alcoholism?
No, not once, not twice, never. How could I exclude what probably had more effect on my life than anything else? No, that's a big component, big, big part of my development and my career.
I want a friend out here with me. Actually, I've had quite a variety of friends out here with me through the years.
Angel in the Wings, Canadian Club, Pal Joey, Beaujolais Village, Call Me Madam, White Wine, On Your Toes, Doers, Bus Stop, Schlitz, Goldilocks, anything I could get my hands on. Sail Away. Oh, well, Dom Perignon, Noel Coward.
Judy Garland makes an appearance in the show. You're the man you dated, Marlon Brando. Yeah. The man you loved, Rock Hudson.
No, I didn't love Rock Hudson. I didn't know what love was. No, I was wildly attracted to him. He was a big movie star and handsome. And so how could I be anything else but just attracted to him? No, love. I didn't know what I was. I didn't know anything about that. I was so knocked out by Rock Hudson that I do my hair and makeup in my hotel room just in case I would bump into Rock Hudson at 6 a.m. in the morning on my way to hair and makeup at the studio.
With that in mind, could you just tell me, and I know you have to go to your rehearsal, so right. Some of the names that float up, the people that you've worked with, the actors, the actresses, just some names that float up.
Well, my goodness, Stella Adler, Marlon Brando, Walter Matthau, Tony Curtis. I all went to school with all of those kids. I never worked with him, but I knew Frank Sinatra, who I consider one of the greatest talents that ever lived. Rex Harrison, I consider a near genius performer. You're messing me up now. My head's getting too full of people, so let's press on.
Yeah. What is next?
I'm doing a voiceover part in a movie called Cars with Paul Newman, and I play a 1923 Ford Lizzie. So that's my next part, okay? And I'm working on a cabaret act, which I've never done before, and it's a big challenge to me, and I don't even want to talk about it because I'm getting all scared again. But that's going to be something. If I'm scared of something, I got to do it. With both feet, I want to go into things that frighten me. So.
Elaine Stritch, thank you so much.
Thank you. I enjoyed talking to you. Good times and bum times, I've seen them all, and my dear, I'm still here.
Acting legend Elaine Stritch. Her award-winning show, Elaine Stritch at Liberty, is available on DVD and CD. For more information, check out our website, here-now.org.
I've stuffed the dailies in my shoes, strummed ukuleles, sung the blues, seen all my dreams disappear, but I'm here.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Yes. I'm Robin Young. Get into your radio and join us again. Here and Now.
I'm here. Danced in my scanties. $3 a night was the pay. But I'm here. I've stood on bread lines with the best. Watched while the headlines did the rest. In the Depression, was I depressed? Nowhere near. I met a big financier, and I'm here.